Before the law, I want to read our passage. This is Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And this is God's holy word. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed. And they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw that all the toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. Again I saw vanity under the heaven, under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with the riches, so that he never asks, "For whom am I toiling, depriving myself of pleasure?" This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. But if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice, for he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that second youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all whom he led, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind. Well, church isn't always happy-clappy, and it isn't supposed to be that way, although too much Americana church is that way. And the text today is dealing with something I've kind of given it two titles of a couple of different songs, Only the Lonely, or That's What the Lonely is For. And this is not a very happy topic. And yet I think that it's something that we need to think about and be sober-minded about, because there's a lot of people that are lonely out there. So I'm going to start off, as I have been for the last couple of weeks, with some songs, some titles of songs. Elvis sang this song called, Are You Lonesome Tonight? Do You Miss Me Tonight? Are You Sorry We Drifted Apart? That same year, his friend, Roy Orbison, sang, There Goes My Baby, There Goes My Heart, They're Gone Forever, So Far Apart, But Only the Lonely Know Why I Cry. And I think we all know that this is a very common refrain in country music and rock music, and even an entire genre, the blues, is named for it. From James Taylor's Don't Let Me Be Lonely Tonight to Fogelberg's Lonely in Love, and Mellencamp has a song called Lonely Old Night, and the Little River Band has Lonesome Loser, and Hank Williams has I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, and the Three Dog Night, one is the loneliest number. REO Speedwagon, One Lonely Night. Yes has Owner of a Lonely Heart. Goodness, does it ever end? Their loneliness is usually about some girl that they've lost or been pining over and they can't have. But this is not always what they're singing about with the lonely. The Cars have a video for their epic ballad called Drive that seems to be about the loneliness that occurs when you don't want to deal with the problems in your life. Problems that can get so bad that it seems like the girl in the video has actually been institutionalized. There won't be anyone up to pick you up when you fall. Whitesnake has that famous song, Here I Go Again, and it tells of a drifter born to walk alone on the lonely street of dreams. Here I go again on my own. It doesn't seem to be a state of being that he particularly likes to be in, but it is where he is, so he tries to make the best of it. Lord Huron, whose music is like watching a Clint Eastwood Western, sings of landing on an island coast where the only souls he sees are ghosts. He's been dreaming again of a lonesome world where I'm lost and I've got no friends, just the rocks and the trees and my lonesome dreams and a road that don't never end. also sung by Elvis and many others, and made more popular in a bit more recent times by the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the Fairfield Four recorded the old gospel folk song called Lonesome Valley, which tells about the lonely walk that every single one of us has to make to the valley of the shadow of death. And they say, nobody else can walk it for you. And in spite of how me and some of my friends sometimes joke about people, they're so frustrating. Loneliness is truly one of the great problems of life. Here's a bunch of quotes about it. Anne Hathaway, the actress, said, loneliness is my least favorite thing about life. The thing that I am the most worried about is just being alone with anybody to care for or someone who will care for me. Tom Hanks is similar. Everybody has something that chews them up, and for me, that thing was always loneliness. Woody Allen, sounding like the Buddha, said, life is full of misery, loneliness, and suffering, and it's all over much too soon. Whitney Houston, who I believe was killed by loneliness, put it simply, loneliness comes with life. Claire Danes said, fame doesn't end loneliness. Joan Collins said, loneliness is the universal problem of rich people. Albert Schweitzer said, we are all so much together, but we are all dying of loneliness. Mother Teresa said, loneliness and that feeling of being unwanted is the most terrible poverty. Buffalo Bill, you're like, where did he come from? He said, the West of the old times, with its strong character, its stern battles, its tremendous stretches of loneliness, can never be blotted from my mind. See, it doesn't matter who you are, rich or poor, famous or anonymous, a man or a woman, a boy or a girl, sometimes we all feel lonely. Some people feel like that all the time. Some people are like that all the time. Now we're a quarter of a way through Ecclesiastes. Beginning at the end of chapter 3, we move into the second quarter by looking at three themes: evil in society, power and how it's abused, and the cult or the religious system. And then these turn back again on themselves as we make our way through chapter 6, meaning that next week, as we talk about the religious system, is the center of this. Now, in Ecclesiastes 4, evil in society and power combine in a very interesting way that links them both together through this depressing topic of loneliness. Last time we looked all the way through verse 6 of chapter 4, so it would seem natural to continue this week by just starting in verse 7. In fact, some see verse 7 through 16 as its own natural unit of thought. Others see 4 through 16, so a little bit more, but the more I thought about it, the more I said to myself that we really need to look at the whole chapter together. In fact, we must even look back again into chapter 3 to truly figure out where this line of investigation into evil and power and religion comes from, because it was that famous verse where it says, God has put eternity into man's heart. It's so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end, that I believe forms the root that now branches off into this investigation of loneliness in chapter 4. And you'll see why that matters before we're finished. How is the passage structured? Which I always find helpful to kind of figure out very quickly the highlights of the text. We can divide it into four different units of I saw, where each unit begins with that observation that the preacher saw something. And then these match up with four statements of under the sun, which all fall in the same units. So first, he sees an injustice regarding oppressors and the oppressed. Next, he sees the vanity of a man envying his neighbor. Third, he sees another vanity, a man working by himself, in fact, toiling for himself with no son or brother. And then finally, he sees a contrast between a poor, wise youth and a foolish, old king. And as we look at these units, we notice that the first and the last have something in common, while the middle two also share something in common. So the first and the last have two parties. You have oppressed and oppressor, and then you have the poor and the rich. or the young and the old, or the wise and the foolish, all in that last one. Now, of course, kings are the chief oppressors of the ancient world, and so the two units are related. The middle, while each having two parties, nevertheless deal with the solitary individual. One is the fool, who folds his hands and eats his own flesh, while the other toils by himself. And so they are chiastically related in those ways, meaning that they can help you to interpret each other. In all this, there's a tie that binds all four observations together, and this is the idea of loneliness. In the first unit, neither the oppressed nor possibly the oppressor have anyone to comfort them. They are, in a word, alone. In the second unit, as we saw last time, the fool, who is folding his hands and eating his own flesh, is in fact the hard worker who's working for himself and not others. He's a miser, he's a hoarder, he's a selfish Scrooge whose refusal to share what he has made with others has caused him to be shunned by his neighbor who's given him the evil eye. The evil eye becomes the cause of his own wasting away, kind of a self-cannibalism, a state of being that will not be changed until he sees the error of his ways, because he, too, is all alone. In fact, they probably both are. In the third unit, the similar hard worker has no other, either son or brother. He is alone, and his condition is so pitiable that it becomes the longest and most obvious reflection on the state of loneliness in the chapter. And then finally, you have an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to take advice. He likewise is alone, for even though he led many people during his reign, he listens to no one and no one rejoices over him when he's dead. And so in this way, we have four different kinds of situations that people find themselves in where loneliness reigns. And in fact, it's possible to see the center of all this in verse 10. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to pick him up. That's exactly what the car is saying. Who's going to pick you up when you fall? See, even unbelievers can see the misery of loneliness and they want to help one another through it. Now, one of the most terrible forms of loneliness comes from the outside. It's imposed by someone else in the form of oppression. So we're going to look at the first three verses here. Now, if you type oppression into Google, you get a plethora of woke social justice terms like exploitation, where you use people's labors to produce profit while not compensating them fairly, or marginalization, where you confine a group of people to a lower social standing. Or powerlessness. Some in a society are relegated to a position of powerlessness by the dominating ruling class. Cultural imperialism, making the culture of the ruling class the social norm and defining all others as deviant and inferior. Or the word violence shows up. Members of some group who live with the knowledge that they must fear random, unprovoked attacks. Every one of those definitions takes a true wrong in this world and redefines a biblical way of viewing injustice perpetrated against an individual by putting it in terms of a group injustice using Marxist categories of stereotypes, forced redistribution, and supposed fairness. The solution to the problem that they have ends up solving nothing. In fact, it fosters more hatred and division among groups than there was to begin with, as it simply changes the situation of outcomes, for example, by using an external power like the government to force the oppressor to become the oppressed, while it supposedly relieves the oppressed of its oppression by putting it into positions of power. And all this is dealing with groups, not individuals, and so it's all about skin color and sexual orientation and on and on. Those who think this is a good idea have not stopped to consider the possible paradox of these first three verses of our passage that we looked at last time. So it is true that it is a horrible thing to be oppressed. Notice that oppression generates, in verse 1, tears of the oppressed. They get that right. I think we all naturally and instinctively understand why. Obviously, You know, a student being humiliated by a teacher, or a slave being whipped by a master, or a child being manhandled physically or sexually by an adult, or many other forms of oppression on the individual level, it generates many, many tears. And as the preacher says, they had no one to comfort them. They're alone in their suffering. And this can also happen on a group level. We read in Psalm 137, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion and what God had done to bring us into captivity." But what these social justice warriors have not stopped to consider is how at the end of the day, once they've turned the tables on the oppressor, they've reversed the roles, they get their payback for all the wrongs that were done to them, now they are in the position of power. Now they are able to become the oppressor, and they've not escaped the problem. Because as it says, on the side of the oppressors, there was power and no one to comfort them. Now, I don't want to go in order here. I want to skip to verses 13 through 16, because I wanted to compare it with the first section here, because they seem to be related to me. Verse 13, "Better was a poor and wise young youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice." So you can see that it's contrasting opposites here, right? You have a poor but wise youth and an old and foolish king. So you have wise and foolish, that makes sense. That's opposite. Young and old, that's opposite. But why does it say a poor versus a king? Why not a peasant versus a king? Or a poor versus the rich? Well, it might be because he has the first observation in mind, and the king is the oppressor, and he's alone. Kings were the chief oppressors of the ancient world because they had the power to do anything they wanted, and with much power comes much, not responsibility, but corruption, evil. And in this case, the king has grown old, and he's become a fool because he has no longer knew how to take advice. There's a whole lot of Proverbs that talk about this. Proverbs 11, 14, "For a lack of guidance a nation falls, but many advisors make victory sure." Proverbs 15, 22, "Plans fail for lack of counsel, but with many advisors they succeed." Proverbs 20, 18, "Make plans by seeking advice. If you wage war, obtain guidance." Proverbs 24, 6, "For waging war you need guidance, and for victory many advisors." Those are all dealing with the king. Tremper Longman says, "One important point of these references is that failure to seek and follow advice dooms royal ventures to failure. This is why ignoring advice is a mark of a fool." You can go again to Solomon's life, as we've been doing almost every week. We can see how he went astray. After much money, fame, power, and women, he clearly did not take Moses' advice, which was actually God's advice, which was actually God's law in Deuteronomy 17, that the king was not supposed to seek these things. Even with wisdom driving him, you see, he was becoming the fool because he would not listen to God. This idea of not taking advice is even more pronounced in the story of his son Rehoboam, who at the beginning of his reign was actually given the opportunity to be a wise king. And they asked him if he would lighten the load and the burden of the oppression of the people that was put on them by Solomon. And so he goes to these old counselors and they say, "Yes, that would be great. And you would forever be loved by everyone." And Rehoboam said, "I'm not going to listen to you." So he goes to the younger men, seeks their counsel. And they said, "You should multiply their oppression and make life absolutely miserable for everyone, except for those in your court." And he took their advice. And he split the kingdom in half, and he died a despised king. It seems that power had gotten to King Rehoboam, and this king is utterly alone because of his foolishness. Look at verse 14. It now says, "He went from prison to the throne, though his own kingdom had been born poor. So it's possible that this refers to the king, that he went from rags to riches. But it's also possible that this refers to the youth who then becomes king in his place. That kind of reminds a lot of people of Joseph, a boy who had very little when he was born. He was sold into slavery by his brothers. He went to prison because of Potiphar's wife. And then virtually ascended to the throne of Egypt, becoming second only to the Pharaoh. Of course, Joseph isn't an exact match, but the idea that comes along with who is wiser than the king, it matches Joseph. And along with thinking about Rehoboam, those two can serve as living analogies for what I think the observation is here. Now, in this observation, we have the only one of our four that does not begin with "I saw." In this case, "I saw" comes in the third verse of it. This is verse 15. So he says, "I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all whom he had led, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after wind." Now, this vision where he says, "I saw," it was set up by the circumstances of the previous pair of opposites. But there's a question here in verse 15. Who is in mind? So the ESV actually completely leaves out a word of the Hebrew, totally untranslated. It's a word that we see earlier in the chapter, which we will come to soon enough. And the word is the word "second." So this is where it literally reads, "along with that second youth." And so the question is, what second youth? While it isn't possible to answer definitively, just like it isn't possible to know for sure whether it was the king or the poor wise youth who went from prison to the throne, I take it that the second refers to the position, not the person. That is, there's only one youth in the observation, not two. And this youth rose all the way to the second in command. And then, when the fool dies, he becomes the king. And I think that's what the ESV is doing in leaving it out. That's why it doesn't translate the word, making it clear that there's only one youth. It doesn't want to confuse you there. Now, in that way of reading, the focus on loneliness remains central. This is seen in the last verse, verse 16. "There was no end of all the people, of all whom he led, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him." He was a foolish and wicked king. He probably oppressed many people. He was alone in his oppression, and he was alone on his throne. Even though throngs of people were in his kingdom, no one cared about him. No one loved him. No one rejoiced in his life. When he died, no one missed him. That brings cohesion to what otherwise seems to be an out-of-place observation that really has nothing to do with what comes before it or after it. And the point I want to make here is that it doesn't matter what kind of power you might gain for yourself in this life, it can't stop the loneliness, especially when it's used for foolish ends. So let's go up to the second one. This is verses 4 through 6. Now again, we looked at this one last time, so I want to look at it from this new perspective of loneliness. So let me recap it, because it's an interesting thing to look at and kind of difficult to understand. There are two people that are in view. There's a worker and the neighbor. He says, "Then I saw all the toil and all the skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor." Now, I suggest that what's going on here is not that the neighbor starts to work hard out of envy like the fool to keep up with the fool, like keeping up with the Joneses. That's the way the ESV reads. Rather, that the fool is the hardworking man who's working only for himself, and this causes the neighbor to first envy and then only get angry, giving him the evil eye because he's so selfish with his stuff he won't help anybody else out. That's the way the King James reads it. And that explains verse 5. "The fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh." The fool is not the one who's envying, it's the worker. He's the fool. He's embracing himself. You see, he folds his hands like this. He's doing this kind of a thing. This is a self-embrace, bringing about the evil eye, which in turn causes the foolish worker to waste away in this self-cannibalization. And the key is the self-embrace. The only person who loves him is himself. He has nobody else because he doesn't care about anybody else. He's a miser and a Scrooge. And in this, his loneliness is completely self-inflicted. And then verse 6 brings this theme out even more. "Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind." Now, quietness comes from what it translates as a handful. Now, literally, this is one, which is an open, flat hand. That is, when he becomes generous, the evil eye is taken back and peace exists between the two. Because he has an open hand. He's one open hand, okay? He's giving. But if stinginess continues, then strife and contention are the sure and certain result, which is a striving after the wind. And this is the contrast here. You have the word two fists, which is what it should be. I have no idea why they just translate it as two hands full. The word is literally fist. They're fighting each other. And I want to point out the word two here because that's going to become major in our third section. And the point here is that you have these two people, one is stingy, one's angry, and they're fighting each other, and both of these parties end up being alone. Because that's what sin always does. Because by its definition, sin is a separation, isn't it? And what does that cause? Loneliness. It's separation from the good, from the law, from God, and from one another. Like I said earlier, when we were reading the law, there's a lot of sinning going on in these passages that he's observing, that he's seeing with his eyes. So let's go to the last one. This is verses 7 through 12. And this whole idea is brought to the forefront here in this last pairing, which is the longest. It starts with, again, I saw vanity under the sun. So what is the vanity he sees this time? One person who has no other, either son or brother. Now, this is the most easy to see of all four of these. This is truly a man who is alone. He has no one. He has no family, no siblings. He has no children. You think of the orphan, or the widow, or the only child, or the divorcee, or the person ripped from their family, or kidnapped, or stolen. Or perhaps it's even just by his own choice. He just leaves everyone he loves, and he goes away. It could be any of these. It could be all of these. This person now becomes like the man in verse 3. He's a worker, you see? And so it gives a parallel to the second set there. There's no end to all his toil. So he works, and he works, and he toils away day and night, month after month, year after year. And now look at the end of verse 8. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches. And in that way, he's also very similar to the man of verses 3 and 4, the man who just works to get stuff for himself, never sharing his wealth with anyone. And in this case, it's more obvious because he is insatiable in his lust for money. And that, in turn, causes him to become blind to the theme of our passage. Now, the very end of verse 8, he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?" The man in mind is consumed with, as Fogelberg poetically puts it, the power of gold. He says, the story is told of the power of gold and its lure on the unsuspecting. It glitters and shines and it badgers and blinds. And it constantly needs protecting. Balance the cost of the soul you lost with the dreams that you lightly sold. Are you under the power of gold? And in Dan's song, he actually enjoys the rewards of his labor. The women are lovely, the wine is superb. He keeps singing that over and over. And then he ends, but there's something about the song that disturbs you. For the preacher, the worker doesn't even care about pleasure at all. That's how consumed he is with gold. And no wonder he calls this vanity and an unhappy business. How many people are like this? Now, as the preacher sees this evil, he begins to reflect on what is in fact the central message of my sermon. And I think of the chapter, and it comes in the form of a proverb, verse 9, two are better than one. So there's that number two again. Remember I said it wasn't even translated one of the times, but here it is. And it's now directly contrasted with one. So why are two better than one? Well, if I was to ask you that question, I think you could come up with all kinds of reasons, but here are the inspired scriptures that give you four of them to think about. First, because they have a good reward for their toil. So what does that mean? Well, the context is both labor and also, along with the second observation, miserliness. And so the good reward consists in this, that each one of the two has the pleasant consciousness of doing good to the other by his labor, and especially of being helpful to him. And in this latter general sense, it's grounded in the idea of the reward of faithful fellowship. So two people are working together, they're helping each other out as they work, and this helps them both in many ways. The preacher continues, if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. That's a second way in which two are better than one. It might refer to traveling on a journey, or it might be taken metaphorically. The point is clear, as it's seen by the inverse parallel, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Who's going to pick you up when you fall? The preacher cries out a howling cry upon such a person. He says, woe! How terrible it is to be in that situation. The third example comes to us in verse 11. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. Now, the Targum reads this the way many of you might, as marital companionship, whether it is physical intimacy or simply proximity. It might also be understood as the second of three examples that are all related to a journey. So it might be that two companions are traveling together and it gets very cold, and so they can warm one another up with their body heat. High mountain rescues where exposure is an issue is a great example of this. The rescuer saves the frostbitten person, but the only immediate relief is to warm them up as quickly as possible. And then he gives a fourth example in the 12th verse that's related to a journey. And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. Longman gives the background. The last example also finds its most natural setting during a journey. The roads in the ancient Near East were often hazardous as one traveled beyond the effective control of towns and cities. A lone traveler, according to Ecclesiastes, was easy prey for robbers, while two could provide resistance and aid to one another. Reminds you of Jesus' parable, doesn't it? The guy who was beat up on the road. So in this way, the whole chapter giving example after example through a series of observations about evil and power, about one and two, how this world is a lonely place. It doesn't seem to matter if you're oppressed or an oppressor, if you're powerful or powerless, if you're rich or poor, a king or a peasant, young or old, whether you're in plenty or in need. Loneliness can strike at any time. And this can be every bit as pitiable and terrible as the person who truly is alone in this world with nothing but themselves to drive them on. If you are lonely, I want you to know first that you're not alone in being lonely. There's a lot of other people who are lonely, and that makes the whole thing kind of ironic, doesn't it? Now, with that song by the Cars and its allusion to Ecclesiastes here, it's going to pick you up when you fall. I want to address those of you who feel lonely and those of you who are lonely. Because of what I said earlier, this can be all of us from time to time. For some, they're in a condition of loneliness that they just can't ever seem to get out of. For some, it's self-imposed, things they do to exacerbate their own loneliness. For some, it isn't, and they don't do that at all. Whatever the case, it's a serious problem that we've seen leads the preacher to pronounce woe and vanity and unhappiness. If loneliness is a problem, the first question to ask is, can it be solved? Yes, and it might even come from our own passage, though it certainly comes from the previous chapter to which it is related. The first step, as with any problem, is you have to acknowledge your loneliness. If you don't acknowledge it, you can't deal with it. You have to acknowledge that you're lonely. The song's refrain says, you can't go on thinking nothing's wrong, so who's going to drive you home tonight? Imagine a drunk driver. He's so sloshed he can't even touch his nose with his finger. But he gets behind the wheel anyway. Halfway home, he crashes. He kills himself and some unfortunate souls in the other vehicle. See, the stakes of being lonely are in fact nothing short of that. How many people have committed suicide from loneliness? How many others have gone on killing sprees from loneliness? I want to ask a question here for a minute. Is loneliness a sin? My answer is it can be if it causes you to worship yourself. It can be for other reasons as well, but even if it is just the never-ending sadness that fuels other feelings like worthlessness and unimportance and self-pity, or a strange desire to only want to isolate yourself all the more, those things are often sinful themselves. The first step is to recognize it for what it is. You might be a sad widow who spends all her time looking at the windows and walls. You might be in a house full of siblings with loving parents, always around people, going to church weekly, keeping fairly busy with life, and you still feel utterly alone. Maybe this is keeping you from deepening your relationship with God. Maybe it's keeping you from God altogether. Maybe you blame him for your loneliness. Now, since I've been giving you so many lyrics from so many songs lately, and I've wanted to do this for years and just have never had the opportunity, I want to add a big one to the list here. It's a series of songs by folk singer David Wilcox that each deal directly with the lonely. And the words are very powerful. I'll never forget the first time I heard this record. Okay, it was a CD. But it wasn't an MP3. It's old. These words are powerful. So in the first song, he asks what the lonely is for. What do you mean? What is it for? Well, he thinks it's given to each of us for a very good reason. What do you mean it's given to us? The lonely is given to us and it's for something? Well, let's take a look at what loneliness presupposes. He says, picture your hope. Okay, so you have hope in your mind, some kind of hope, your heart's desire. Now picture that as a castle that you must keep. In all of its splendor, it's drafty with lonely. This heart is too hard to heat. But when I get lonely, that's only a sign. Some room is empty, and that room is there by design. If I feel hollow, that's just my proof that there's more for me to follow. That's what the lonely is for. He says you can seal up the pain, build walls in the hallways, close off a small room to live in, but those walls will remain and keep you there always, and you'll never know why you were given the lonely. Given the lonely. The lonely is given to us. Yes, it's given to us. We were given loneliness to teach us that by ourselves we are not enough. Loneliness presupposes that relationship is more basic. Now that seems backwards. Shouldn't being alone be more basic? Because I came into this world by myself. No. God made Adam and found that he needed a helper. God gave you a mother to give you birth. Yet even with others, we are not enough. So in a second song on the same album, he likens each of us to a cup. He says, some love to pour themselves out until they're empty, filling others up, but they have no time for themselves. Most love to have others pour themselves into us because they are empty. But he says, we're all broken cups, which is very clearly a metaphor for sin. We're unable to hold much water for long enough to fill even ourselves up, let alone somebody else. But he says, if we go to the waterfall, that is to God, we will always be full of water, even though there's a break in the cup that holds love inside of all of us. Now, there's a third song on the album where he sings about the hopelessness of life and yet the hope that's right there in the middle of it. He says, you say you see no hope. Now, this is interesting because in that earlier song, he started off saying, picture your hope, your heart's desire. And now he says, you say you see no hope. You say you see no reason that we should dream that the world should ever change. You say that love is foolish to believe. You say because there's always going to be some crazy with an army or a knife who will wake you from your daydream and put the fear back in your life. He says, look, if someone wrote a play just to glorify what's stronger than hate, would they not arrange the stage to look as if the hero came too late? He's almost in defeat. It's looking like the evil side will win. So on the edge of every seat, from the moment that the whole thing begins, it is love who makes the mortar. And it's love who stacked the stones, and it's love who made the stage here, although it looks like we're alone. In the scene, set in shadows like the night is here to stay, there's evil cast all around us, but it's love that wrote the play. And in the darkness, love can show the way. That's such a great song. I'm going to give you the second line to it. Now the stage is set. You can feel your own heart beating in your chest. This life's not over yet. So we get up on our feet and do our best. We play against the fear. We play against the reasons not to try. We're playing for the tears burning in the happy angel's eyes. For it's love who mixed the mortar, and it's love who stacked the stones, and it's love who made the stage here, though it looks like we're alone. In the scene set in shadows, like the night is here to stay, there is evil cast around us, but it's love that wrote the play. And in this darkness, love will show the way. And of course, love is God. And he ends here with darkness. We saw way back in chapter 3, verse 11, this theme. This is the tie-in to chapter 3. God has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put darkness into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. And though he is not mentioned by name, this same God is not far from us in chapter 4. Someone explains how in the first three verses of our chapter, the oppressed and the oppressor, it's quite possible, especially when you read Job, that the one who is bringing oppression can actually be God himself. Job feels oppressed by God. With Job, God permitted the oppression. In fact, he oversaw it through Satan in order to bring Job to the end of himself. The Targum on Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 10 is another example. Here, it is not two men, but two righteous men. I'm trying to show you that God is here in our chapter. These righteous men are better than one. Together they have a good reward in the world to come because they labor to support their generation. The one who falls, falls because of sickness. The one who raises, raises him in prayer. That's how the Targum interprets it. In fact, in verse 13 it says, better is Abraham, who was a poor boy, but had in him the spirit of wisdom from the Lord, and whose maker became known to him when he was 3 years old and did not want to worship idols, than the wicked Nimrod, who was an old and foolish king. And my point is simply, there is something throughout this chapter that's driving us beyond the loneliness itself to something far greater. And this is driven by the fact that God has put this desire in our heart to search it out. And this takes me to the very last part of chapter 4. I have not mentioned one little tiny bit here. Maybe you thought I forgot it. This is the end of verse 12. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Now, good commentaries recognize here a link throughout this section to the old Sumerian Gilgamesh epic. The fascinating story has Gilgamesh, who's two-thirds god and one-third man. He goes out on a mission with his trusted friend Enkidu, who's a half-man and a half-beast. And Enkidu's about to stop and give up his mission, but Gilgamesh tells him, stop, Enkidu. The second man will not die. The boat in tow will not sink. No man will cut the three-ply cord. And so the point would be, to draw upon a well-known story in order, like Solomon or Rehoboam or Abraham or Joseph or Nimrod, to make the metaphor more concrete. But what most modern commentaries do not like is interpreting this verse spiritually. They want a one-to-one, very naturalistic way of reading this. They look to the literalistic level. Such things as tying together weaker strands of cord, creating a stronger cord, and then applying it directly to the topic at hand. For example, someone says the point of the image of the three-strand cord is rather that strength can be gained through human relationships. That's as far as he takes it. And of course, that's completely true. But this isn't the only way the church fathers read it. They often look to the spiritual. For example, Ambrose said, and that you may understand it to be said as a mystery. So he's saying, this is a mystery, this verse. And not in reference to the bare number that two are better than one, he adds the mystical saying, a threefold cord is not quickly broken. For that which is threefold and uncompounded cannot be broken. Thus, the Trinity, being of an uncompounded nature, cannot be dissolved. For God is whatever he is, one and simple and uncompounded. And what he is, that he continues to be, and is not brought into subjection. Gregory the Great said, by a cord, faith is expressed, as Solomon witnesses, who says, a threefold cord is not easily broken, because faith in truth that is woven by the mouth of preachers from the knowledge of the Trinity remains firm in the elect. It is broken only in the heart of the reprobate. You will read modern commentators calling these, quote, forced Christological or Trinitarian interpretations. See, moderns don't like this. But as a fellow who wrote on this text, giving these fathers as quotations, talks about, the origin of this saying is probably Middle Eastern wisdom traditions. And so it's, from a literary point of view, in the context of Ecclesiastes, this motif of a cord of three strands acts as a symbol inviting the reader to connect it with situations of his or her life. In other words, it's poetic for precisely the reason that it can be applied spiritually. And why wouldn't you? God is the original three in one. He is the eternally unlonely triune God. He predates all analogies, and therefore it's only proper that such analogies first point not to our situation, but to his. The one in three mystery points you to the triune God who has put eternity in our hearts so that we might in fact look at loneliness that he puts in our lives and seek him. Now, of course, none of us do seek him, not until we hear the good news, which is his power to save whom he wishes. And when his people hear the good news, they believe him that he fills that loneliness in a way that no other being can or should. Don't let your wife or your children or whatever else try to fill the loneliness, friends. Too many people do that. Only God can do this. That's what the loneliness is for. And I want to ask you, have you heard him telling you this today? C.S. Lewis said, look for yourself and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ and you will find him. And with him, everything else is thrown in. Josh McDowell said, while the resurrection promises us a new and perfect life in the future, God loves us too much to leave us alone to contend with the pain, guilt, and loneliness of our present life as Christians. The promise of the gospel hits squarely at the lack of comfort experienced by the very first lonely person in our passage, those who have no one to comfort them. Whether that lack of comfort is from circumstances outside of you, or from your own sin, which is itself a separation from God, and therefore by definition a loneliness, it doesn't matter. It is into this helpless, hopeless condition that the gospel says, comfort, comfort, my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned. See, the gospel tells you that this pardon comes through Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who gave himself over to the ultimate loneliness when he was forsaken of his eternal fellowship with his God on the cross, so that those who believe might know that there is never a loneliness to be had for them again. And I think that's a story that's worth telling. Even more, it's a story that's worth believing. If you are lonely, and like I said, we all struggle with this from time to time, listen to the gospel. There's no one to comfort them, says Ecclesiastes. Comfort, comfort my people, says Isaiah. Loneliness is a horrible curse, just like some of our celebrities came to realize. It's better to be with others than without them. But even them, if they are humans, will fail us and bring about inevitable loneliness that is caused by their sin and by our sin. God never fails. And he never leaves or forsake those who are in Christ, whom he calls to himself. Two and three are strong together, but the one who knows God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, is infinitely stronger, having been given a fellowship with the Creator himself that will never be lost and never be forgotten. It is not good that man should be alone, God said. If you trust in the Lord Jesus, you never will be. And you will always know the truth, even if you sometimes suppress it in sin, even if it comes from without and causes you not to see it. And that is good news, isn't it? Come to him and know eternal love and fellowship. And then even in the futility of this life and the inevitable temporal loneliness, taste and see that you are never truly alone when Christ dwells within you. Otherwise, know that this nagging, depressing emptiness that you feel will never be taken away until you do. Lord, I pray that you would bless your word today. As this is such a heavy topic, very deep, hard to talk about. When people are feeling lonely, they don't usually want to talk about it with somebody else. It's part of the cycle of the loneliness. I pray that your word would penetrate into the darkness of loneliness in people's hearts today, and that you would, by your great power of the gospel and the living word of Christ, come into the hearts and the minds of all those who hear this. Bring the dead to life, bring the sad into a state of happiness and blessedness, as the Beatitudes tell us. Show us that Christ suffered the loneliness so that we might not have to. And show us that that has been something that he won and that he is going to give to all those the Father gives him. And I pray, Lord, that you would do this for the sake of your people, that you would encourage us, that we may not leave here feeling vanity and feeling emptiness and feeling unhappiness, but rather that we leave being filled, having had fellowship and communion with our living Savior by his Holy Spirit, and with one another whom you have given to us as your body. We ask you bless the words to these ends in Christ's name.